Aloha, and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. He's referred to in the state's official report on the January 13th ballistic missile alert as Employee 1. He's the man who sent out the alert, and by his account, he's being thrown under the bus. We'll get his story in his words.
An independent third party talks best practices and weighs in on Hawaii's missile alert mistake. Should the phrase, "this is not a drill," have been included in the warning message? And the recent death of a lava tour operator gives us pause. Was it due to a noxious gas cloud or something else? We talk safety with the National Park Service.
Hawaii Opera Theater keeps it light with a comedic classic, The Daughter of the Regiment. It's Friday, February 9th, and the conversation starts right after the news. Was he the bad apple in the barrel or a scapegoated victim set up to fail by a flawed system? The State Emergency Management Agency worker who triggered the January 13th missile alert disputes the state's account of the events of that Saturday morning. We spoke yesterday and asked him to tell us his story.
It was a normal Saturday morning. I came in for day shift, and I was on time. My co-workers were there. We walked into the office. My supervisor wasn't there, though. He was late that morning, and we went into the office. The midnight shift supervisor was there, and then she suddenly left the office as I saw my day shift supervisor come in, park his car. So we were in the office, and then after a minute or two, I heard over we were logging in to our computers, and I heard the phone ring on the secure phone, the one we use from Pacific Command to receive missile alerts. The phone rang as I was logging in. The phone is behind me, so I didn't see who answered it, but one of my coworkers answered the phone instead of using speakerphone like we're supposed to do. And I didn't hear the beginning of the message, which says, "exercise, exercise, exercise." The coworker put the receiver down and put it on speakerphone after a short period. And what I heard was, "this is not a drill." And then at the end of the message, I didn't hear "exercise, exercise, exercise" either. And so the energy in the room felt different than our previous drills. It seemed very real to me, and I was 100% convinced that it was a real situation. Supervisors weren't there. The one supervisor, the midnight shift supervisor, she I found out later that she initiated the call. Yet I didn't recognize her voice, and my coworker admitted afterward that she didn't either. And my day shift supervisor was in the hallway. He didn't come into the office until later. And so I was 100% sure. And I did what I was trained to do, and I went into after I brought the program up on my workstation, I sent the message, the alert out, which is a two-step process. And
what are those two steps?
Well, it's first you click, and it's a drop-down menu, and then you select the link, and then it second message comes up, basically, "are you sure?" And I click that also.
So there's two steps, but they're two steps done by one person. Does the second person look over that at the time you're doing it? Do you have a separate sign-off on that, or is that all you at that point?
It's all me. There was no second person that needed to see it, or no one saw it.
That strikes me as a lot of weight to put on one person. Did it feel that way to you?
Exactly, and I found out later that they're correcting that issue now. They make two people sign off on the process now.
Well, because one of the questions that a lot of people asked in the immediate aftermath of that is that, don't you have a second person double-checking your actions at a case like that?
Exactly. It shows you how much confidence they had in me. I was there. I worked there for 11 and a half years, and I was a trusted employee there, and I serve the supervisor 1 or 2 days a week for my shift. And so it's had a lot of confidence in me.
As you know, in the report, I think it's the January 30th report, you're not described as a particularly trusted employee. What's the difference there? What happened there?
Yeah, it's perplexing to me. I was surprised to read that.
You hadn't had indications in your day-to-day, previous 11 years that they were, there were job actions being contemplated, people had reservations about your work?
Not at all. I didn't have any issues.
The employee says the only time he was written up by management was for failure to fill out the proper vacation request form. The official Emergency Management Agency report, released January 29th, disputes that account. It reads, quote, "Employee 1 has been a source of concern for the same State Warning Point, or SWP, staff for over 10 years. Employee 1's poor performance has been counseled and documented, and the SWP members have stated that they are not comfortable with Employee 1 as a supervisor, two-man team, or as part of the SWP in general. He does not take initiative and has to be directed before he takes action. He is unable to comprehend the situation at hand and has confused real life and drills on at least 2 separate occasions." In the case of exercises like this, this is at the highest level of intensity, obviously, for any kind of exercise like that. When you drill, as you said, when you do your training, are there prior exercises kind of leading up to it? In the military, they refer to this as a culminating exercise, where you have had a series of other events that kind of prepare you for something like this. Did you have anything like that as part of your training?
No, not really. This exercise was a total surprise. The two supervisors sprang it on us workers on a Saturday morning while we were transitioning between shifts. So we were vulnerable at the time also. Workstations weren't brought up. We wouldn't log in to our computers yet. And the drills up to that point in the month or two before that, there were usually errors and mistakes by the workers. It's a learning process, of course, but the procedures and processes were always changing also.
When you describe prior mistakes, as you say, in prior drills, were then evaluated and addressed and corrected in the aftermath of those prior drills?
Yes, we looked at those, tried to correct those as time went on, but it was difficult because the programs, the IT programs that we were given, and the procedures were always changing from week to week. From the start of the drilling in November.
Those prior drills, were they specifically for a missile alert, or were they for things like tsunamis and earthquakes and the other kind of things that you folks deal with?
This was just for the missile alert drills that we started in the fall, yeah.
So it's specifically for an event that comes very quickly.
Right. We only had a couple minutes to finish all these tasks.
As you know, drills tend to come at an inconvenient time for the very reason that real-world events tend to come at an inconvenient time, right? So that would be a standard thing that might happen in a drill like this. The question, I guess, is your knowledge of when it was a drill. When did you first hear those words, and take in that something had gone awry here?
Well, I didn't hear any drill announcement or exercise. The word exercise wasn't used. What I heard was, "This is not a drill," and a missile impact time, and et cetera. So it was very real to me. I didn't think it was a drill.
Well, you've seen the timeline in the report that was released on the 30th, and it's very specific. 8:03, 8:06, and approximately when in that timeline did it first come to your attention that this was a drill?
Well, immediately afterwards, the phone started ringing, and we were all answering phones, trying to cancel a message, but we couldn't because IT wasn't there to provide us with a way to cancel it.
IT wasn't there because it was the start of their shift, or because it was Saturday, or what?
On on a Saturday, the staff doesn't work in the ESC, as they call it. So it was just us, the state warning point personnel, nobody else in the whole staff. We have like 50 people in the staff at Haima. All those, well, not all of them, but the IT people had to come in to actually create an alert to, and it took, 39 minutes.
So the personnel were not there to cancel the alert at the time that you learned that it was a mistake?
Right. There was no one else there but us. They had to come in.
How was that addressed?
They called FEMA to get permission to do it, which they didn't need to do. As we were answering phones from the public and from officials, we just did our best to remedy the situation, make it less of an impact, but it was a tough time.
Let me go back just to the event itself, because in the state's report, it does say that there had been two previous occasions where there was some confusion on your part between a drill and a real event. And yet, you're saying those were never reported? There's no record of that?
That's right. That never happened. There's no documentation or anything. I was surprised to hear about that because I was always a good employee, always a team player, and I didn't understand when I read that.
What's your situation now? You've been dismissed?
Yeah, I was discharged, and February 5th was my last day. I had to clean out my desk, in so many words. January 26th is when they notified me that I'd be discharged.
You're a state employee, right?
Yes, a state employee, but my status was exempt.
Are you?
I wasn't civil service.
Are you entitled to benefits?
We're still trying to determine that.
You've said it was a system failure, and could you just sort of, if you had your druthers, what should have been done? How should this moment, this drill, this 8 a.m. thing should have been handled?
Well, leading up to that, in the month or two that we were drilling, the training was inadequate that we were given. The procedures and protocols were always changing. The management couldn't agree on how to proceed with the drills. There was a lot of debate about what tasks should be done by, the order and the sequence and the timing. It was just put on us in a rushed fashion, and we weren't ready for it. We have other things to do with tsunamis and, hurricanes and other things. That this was an added task for us. And we just weren't prepared for it.
In the immediate aftermath that day, that Saturday, what did you do?
It was a tough time for me. I was devastated, and it was like a body blow for me. The whole day, just trying to help out, answering phones. All day, the phone was ringing in from the public. And
so you finished out your work day and then went home for the weekend?
Yeah, that was my last day of the week for me. It was Saturday, and I was off Sunday, Monday. I went back to work Tuesday. And no one asked me what happened in 3 days. They didn't get my story, and so they went to the press with the wrong story.
So you had no contact with your supervisors in the effect of what happened, why did you do that, until the Tuesday after the Saturday?
Right. Tuesday they asked me for my written statement, which I provided to them, Tuesday the 16th, and that was the last day I worked there. So I called in sick the following day and went to my doctor, and because I couldn't sleep well or eat well, he prescribed sleeping pills and such, and I was almost in a depressed state. So it's been tough for me and my family.
That interview with the man known as Employee One was recorded yesterday morning, and you can hear it again on our Facebook page.
Learning from Hawaii's mistake, emergency management experts across the country are taking stock of what went wrong here. GP Strategies is a global company that offers, among other things, emergency management training services. Jo Lafleur is a former FEMA executive who also served as emergency services director in two states and is now with the company's corporate crisis program.
Many of the states on the continental side deal with nuclear power plants and many, many chemical plants. And because of those kinds of emergencies on a frequent basis, as well as large-scale natural disasters, and Hawaii is certainly very familiar with that, I think it's made everybody sharpen up on the national security area and the technological hazards and emergencies in their warning systems and processes and procedures and human factors. So it's been a good wake-up call, and I think there's been a good feeling on the continent about the way Hawaii has addressed this. The immediate introspection led by the Brigadier General, the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency doing its own internal activities and investigations, and the general public oversight of the process. So the transparency's been good, and it has been helpful the way it's been handled. I am aware that a number of the states have checked the design and the visual part of what their operators are seeing and what they're using, and having a stronger verification process, sort of the two-man rule, if you will, of verification, as well as a strengthening of passwords to get into the systems, because they certainly don't want any nefarious actors getting into these warning points and trying to override or take control of the system. So security's getting brushed up as well.
The employee, the so-called button pusher, was telling folks that he really thought it was the real thing and that it was not a drill. And I'm not sure about the language. I know in the message it said, this is not a drill. How common is that in your experience?
It's to the outside world, outside on the continent, it looks like the messages might have been better written or described between the, this is a drill, this is not a drill, and exercise, which he has said he did not hear and then became confused by the language. And I know that many states are going back and looking at their drill and test language to be sure it's very clear and that they would not be susceptible to that in the future. So that was a very unfortunate part of it, and to what degree that contributed to his nervousness of the event, it's hard to tell, but it certainly was a human error that was significant.
But in your experience, is that something you would just normally see in a message? This is not a drill?
No, you wouldn't necessarily see that. Usually it is, this is an exercise message, and it's reemphasized many times. But again, that wouldn't be a wrong thing to do. I certainly don't want to say that, but it was a mixed message in this particular communication that was developed. There's no doubt about that.
That was Jo Lafleur with GP Strategies. We also spoke with Tom Baker, the company's director of government operations. Baker worked as Homeland Security Program Instructor and the Navy's Emergency and Crisis Training Manager as recently as 2012.
You know, when we're working through situations like this, you always go to the process first and blame people last. So when I heard about this situation, you know, my thoughts immediately went to, okay, I wonder what that process was internally and where the breakdown came. And it's unfortunate that it did, but again, my initial thoughts were about the process.
What are the best practices? What do you think that we ought to be looking at going forward?
So, you know, I think certainly whenever we run an exercise at GP Strategies, we always preface every command and every message with exercise. And so as they're going through training, which is obviously so critical, to preface every communication with exercise gets it in everyone's mind. Everyone is aligned that what is happening is, in fact, an exercise. And I can tell you that if training is done right, it sure doesn't feel like an exercise. It is supposed to feel very, very real, because you want to put the trainees under that sort of stress. But the two big things, I think, the two best practices that I could mention are two-person protocol and every message that goes out, both internally and externally, is prefaced with the words exercise, exercise.
And there was an issue about possibly someone picking up the handset so that part of that message was cut off and was not maybe heard by everybody.
Sure. Well, you know, that obviously things can happen like that. People can, what we call, step on each other, where people talk over the top of each other and messages are missed. But if there is a protocol of continually emphasizing that this is in fact an exercise, that can be alleviated. Also, a very good pre-brief about what's going to occur, not giving away, you know, some of the game aspect of it, but certainly letting everyone know that they should not go ahead with a certain procedure because it's an exercise, should be in everyone's mind during the pre-brief and therefore then during the exercise.
Can you talk about the wireless alert system? Because one of the things that was flagged is that not everybody got the message because they had a certain button turned off on their cell phones.
Well, I am not sure of the inner workings of all of the cell phones that are out there on the market, but I can tell you this. When I was in the Pentagon and we had the earthquake that came out of central northern Virginia, you know, personally, I tried to call my wife, but was unable to because the cell phone towers were absolutely overloaded with transmissions. So that is a very common occurrence in disaster situations where in the cell phone age that we have learned that cell phone towers can become easily overloaded. And so that may be one of the reasons that we saw limited or partial dissemination of the message. Other than that, you know, I really can't speak to the specific system or the inner workings of the cell phones.
I guess there's just some concern because when not everybody got it, and if there are limitations to how many characters you can use, you know, versus if you were using the old system where the broadcasters got the message out and there would be a continuous stream of information about emergency shelters, you know, that kind of thing, that you could broadly disseminate good information quickly versus, you know, 20 characters on a text.
Right. So when it comes to that, you know, when you're generating a message, you have to ensure that you're getting the audience right. You have to ensure the urgency is there. And you have to have, in this case, for this particular question, the reliability of the medium that the message is going out across. And therefore, when you're dealing with a disaster situation, you have to have multiple ways to get that message across. Because this was an isolated incident with a one particular message, that may be why multiple systems were not used. Also, when you're dealing with disasters, there are different types of disasters, obviously, or emergency situations. You have emergency situations that allow for a great deal of information to go out over a long period of time. If you think about a hurricane that's brewing, you can wait for a newspaper to come out every single day to tell you every single detail you want to know about that hurricane for days before it actually makes landfall. When you're dealing with a situation like this and you have a exercised you know, missile inbound, or you have an earthquake with a possible tsunami, you have much less time to get the message out and much less time to get it right. And the medium of communication is more limited. So, you know, these are things that you have to think about when you're putting out an emergency message, depending on the situation and depending on the situation, the medium can change, you know, drastically, and the urgency and the quickness that the message has to go out obviously changes.
And do you think there ought to be a standardized message? Just one that deals with missiles, and it's the same across the board in every state?
Difficult question to answer. You know, people react to emergency situations differently. You have to be careful when you have a standardized message that goes out that people in who receive that message in a test situation will react accordingly or appropriately in a real situation. Would it be a good idea? It may be a good idea. I think further study needs to be done. One of the studies that has gone out is that you actually get more reaction from the second notification than the first notification. People need confirmation of the message. If you can imagine yourself in an emergency situation, you get something that comes across your cell phone or you hear a siren, you kind of stand there almost dumbfounded. Is this real? When that second message comes across, that's when people react. And so whether the first message is a standardized message with the second message coming out being a little bit more urgent with detail, or whether you hear a siren and that siren means a certain thing followed by the second siren message, certainly for confirmation for people, yes, I think that is required. But I think more study needs to be done on whether a standardized message across the board, across the country, is the right thing to do.
That was Tom Baker of GP Strategies, one of two emergency management experts sharing their insight about Hawaii's missile alert mistake. We talked to them from their headquarters in Maryland. They agreed that the big challenge ahead is to restore the public's trust in the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency.
We've been collecting your calls and emails throughout our coverage of the fallout from the missile alert, and Troy Fuji wrote this on our Instagram page this week. While it might be convenient and even satisfying to assign blame to the button pusher, the FCC investigation appears to point to deeper underlying deficits in state HIEMA leadership, communication, training, safeguards, and discipline. It's far too convenient to place the bulk of the blame or responsibility upon the button pusher when there are more troubling systemic failures that led to the situation the employees were placed in. State leaders should first take a hard, honest look in the mirror. The failure of the button pusher represents systems failure and dysfunction under their leadership as supervisors and agency officials.
Thanks for your thoughts. You can always reach our talkback line by calling 808-792-8217 or sending an email to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the recent death of a lava tour operator, and we talk about keeping lava safe. But first, your quiz.
Henry Opuka Haya, the native Hawaiian, was born in Po'opo in 1792, and his destiny took him across the continent. He was one of the early converts to Christianity and opened the door to the arrival of Protestant missionaries in the islands. He died at the age of 26 in Connecticut on February 17, 1818. Opuka Haya was laid to rest in a Cornwall churchyard until his family asked that his remains be brought back to Hawaii back in the 1990s. We're looking for the name of the Congregational Church where a memorial to Henry Opuka Haya was built to honor his life as a Christian. If you know the answer, give us a call. The winner of our backyard quiz gets a tote bag that says, "You got it right." And the number to call is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative, Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working, and iDoctors Hawaii.
Yesterday, we hosted a panel discussion of Hawaii's housing challenges, but not everyone made it on air. Here's what a few of you had to say.
Hi, my name is Tiari Irvine, and I'm calling from San Francisco, but I was born and raised on Maui, and I had a comment about affordable housing. And it's my husband and I bought a house on Maui, and we're currently living in San Francisco still. And I've been really struck by the number of people that are not from Maui that are interested in renting that house from us. And so, you know, it's really raised this question of carrying capacity, you know, when it comes to conversations about affordable housing, whether we should also be talking about carrying capacity on an island where land is a finite resource. That's my comment. Thanks.
Hello. This is Alan Pelzer, TA Maui. I want to be like the last guy that moves here. Like, maybe we don't want to encourage anybody else to move here. I don't know if that's the reason that mobile homes are illegal here. You know, we have limited resources here. Limited, everything's limited. That's my comment. Mahalo.
Hi, this is Richard from Haleiwa. I experienced deed-restricted housing in Telluride, Colorado, when I lived there for a couple of years. People buy a house at a lower price, but their home is deed-restricted, and certain restrictions, some can be rentals, some cannot be rentals. But most importantly, when you rent or sell the house, you have to do it at a certain fraction of the average market price. So you don't flip housing. You don't make a fortune. It's so that people can actually own and or rent their homes. There's a certain percentage of the homes that are always going to be more affordable because the deed is permanently restricted according to the cost of housing at the time. It works.
Thanks for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can reach out via social media on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or call our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217.
One of today's finest acoustic fingerstyle folk and blues guitarists, Andy Kimball, brings his original songs and classic covers to HPR's Atherton Studio on Saturday the 17th. Reserve your seats today for an evening of pure Americana. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Andy Kimball in the Atherton, sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Lava tour guide Sean King died after what some believe may have been due to exposure to a hazardous gas cloud. King was well acquainted with the hazards of volcano viewing and had also volunteered with the Volcanoes National Park. It happened last week while King was leading a tour in a remote area, which may have made getting immediate medical help difficult. There are various agencies that share jurisdiction over the Volcanoes area, and there are limited commercial permits available. Now, Jessica Faircaint is with the National Park Service. She knew King personally. As we mentioned, he had served as a volunteer at that park.
The mission of Hawaii Volcanoes National Park is to provide safe access to active volcanism. In 2017, there were more than 2 million visitors to Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. The vast majority of them did not have a bad experience here, health and safety-wise.
Right, and that's really important for you, and that's why you close off areas if the viewing is particularly hazardous.
That's right. Volcanoes, being one of Earth's most dynamic and ever-changing natural features, are inherently dangerous. They present many hazards, whether it is the steam or the gases or the deep cracks or the sharpness of hardened lava or the molten lava itself. There are no lack of hazards associated with active volcanoes. But if they are viewed in a safe manner, you can have a very safe experience.
Now, this particular incident did not happen within your jurisdiction. It was outside the national park's boundaries, correct?
That's correct. The tour operator who died last week was not in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. He was pretty close to the boundary. I think it was about 1,000 feet away from the park boundary. And as far as I know, they have not released autopsy results on Sean King yet, but his death might not be related to lava.
Well, what can you share with our listeners about the importance of minding the rules and staying where officials have deemed to be safe viewing points? Because you have had some fatalities in the park, but my understanding is that they were in areas that were off limits.
That's correct. Since 1990, we've had 5 lava-related deaths in the national park. Unfortunately, all 5 of those were in closed areas.
You folks have recently released a safety video. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we have long told visitors to stay lava safe, and they can do that by staying out of closed areas and obeying all posted signs. Closed areas, for instance, when the lava was going into the ocean from mid-2016 through November of last year, a lot of people went out to go and see lava pouring into the ocean. It's one of the most amazing things you can see. But the bench or the delta of new land that that lava going into the ocean forms is really on an unstable substrate. There were several big collapses of that bench, which creates a lot of hazards in addition to gases. There's flying ballistic pieces of lava rock, et cetera, that come out, and people can also be swept away. So our campaign for that was to keep people away from the delta and its possible collapse. And to do that, we set up a lava viewing area about 900 feet east of the bench. And that was determined by the park and USGS as a safe zone where if there was a collapse or there was an explosion or the wind suddenly changed and brought hydrochloric acid, you know, onto viewers, that they would be far away enough that they would remain safe. So we set up lava viewing areas, not just down at the coast where the lava flows are, but also at the summit of Kilauea at Jagger Museum. There is a viewing area of the summit eruption of that lava lake feature, and that is about 1 mile away.
Now, there are operators that bring tours in by boat, and I know that jurisdiction generally falls under DLNR. There are only certain permits that are allowed. But can you talk about just the winds and, you know, what noxious, you know, clouds of fumes might be blowing and how do visitors know how to make the right decision, whether they think it's a good day to go out or not?
Well, Catherine, there's no lava going into the ocean right now, so there's not really any lava ocean tours happening right now. But the ocean part of an ocean entry, when there is one, that is the jurisdiction of the U.S. Coast Guard as well as the State of Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources. And if the lava goes into the ocean again, I believe that those two agencies have made it the captain's responsibility on how close or far that they want to remain. But you really should contact those sources and get their insight.
Is there any number that visitors can call to get information on your end just about areas that are closed off?
The best place for people to find out more information about Kilauea Volcano, and Kilauea Volcano, keep in mind, is erupting from 2 locations. We have 1 volcano with 2 eruptions. You have the summit eruption here at about 4,000 feet in the main part of a park, just 2 miles from the Kilauea Visitor Center. And then we have the East Rift Zone eruption from Pu'u'o'o, and that's been happening since 1983. The best place, the best source for information is the park website, and that's nps.gov/Hawaii Volcanoes. That is updated regularly. We link to the USGS webcams and the daily Kilauea status update. We talk about any park alerts. Kilauea is not the only hazardous feature in this park. We also have Mauna Loa, and Mauna Loa right now, the summit is closed because we are expecting winter weather with up to 6 to 8 inches of snow and extremely high winds, gusts up to 65 miles an hour from the southwest. So, people are advised to go to the park website to check out any alerts that might be happening in the park.
We checked also with Hawaii County Fire Department about the responses that they get called out to, the 911 calls, and they said their number one call is actually for people who are injured falling off bicycles.
That's not surprising. Yes, they're to get out to where the surface lava flows are, both in the national park and outside of the park. The closest way to reach them is from the Kalapana Lava Viewing Area, which is managed by the County of Hawaii. There are vendors that are not affiliated with the Park Service outside on the county side of things, renting bicycles and providing that mode of transportation for visitors. You know, you're riding out on a very loose gravel emergency access road. It's also riddled with potholes because of heavy rains, and it's not a maintained road. It's an emergency access road that happens to be being used by these bicycle tour companies. And the hazards of the road are, if you haven't ridden a bike and you're not used to a non-asphalt kind of surface, it can definitely be challenging and dangerous for somebody who doesn't have that bicycling experience.
Right, and I think the point is, you know, people might be a little alarmed hearing of the recent fatality, and until we know what the cause of death was and what the conditions are that might have led to his death, people just need to know there are other hazards in the park, and being overcome by hazardous fumes is really, it's pretty rare.
It is really rare to be overcome by hazardous fumes, especially if you are doing the two things that keep you lava safe. By one is staying out of closed area, and two is obeying and heeding all posted signs. The vast majority of the 2 million-plus visitors that come here every year are leaving without a bad experience or without getting hurt or having to take a trip to the hospital. But it's when people don't realize their own capabilities also that they're getting hurt. A lot of people, we treat every single night, we are treating lacerations from people who've slipped and fallen on hardened lava, which, of course, you know, there's a lot of silica or glass in hardened lava, so it's very, very sharp. Even though we do advise everybody, you know, on our website, and rangers tell them all the time, wear long pants, wear gloves, wear, you know, long sleeves if you can, and, you know, to dress appropriately. But the vast majority of people don't, because they're it's hot down there, and they don't want to be in long pants, or they think that the gloves are silly, and they're not going to fall, but, you know, inevitably somebody does end up falling every night.
That was Jessica Hurricane of Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island talking about how people can keep lava safe. In 1993, Henry Opukahi'a remains were brought back to the island from Connecticut. The Big Island native was one of the earliest Christian converts. He was studying to be a priest and was preparing to lead a mission back to the islands when he became ill with typhoid fever and died. This weekend, the story of his life will take center stage. Glory of His Soul is a musical drama written by Randy Hong based on Opukahi'a's journals. It will be performed at Kalihi Union Church over the next several weekends, marking the anniversary of his death. Opukahi'a's remains are now at home at Kahikolu Church, overlooking Kealakekua Bay. And that's the answer we were looking for.
And Catherine Yuli Matthews, who is from the Big Island, is now in Laliha, was the first to get that right. This is a popular quiz, and a number of people from Hawaii Island called in, but Yuli was the first. He'll be getting a tote bag from HPR. And if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. In the right hands, comedy is a universal communicator, and classic comedies from an earlier era, even if they're set long ago and far away and told in a different language, can still hit the funny bone. Donizetti's Daughter of the Regiment tells one of those stories where everything gets hopelessly entangled, but you know it will all work out in the end, with plenty of laughs along the way. Brian Diedrich is the director of the Hawaii Opera Theater production, which runs this weekend in Honolulu. He told us about the show.
I think that's one of the great experiences with Donizetti, because there's something very modern. When I listen to the overture, in fact, I get a real sense of, 1930s or 1940s jazz riffs at certain points. And the humor, I suppose humor works all the time. A pratfall is a pratfall is a pratfall.
Yeah.
And what with us doing the dialogues in English and the music in French, you have that great opportunity to play back and forth. And mm-hmm. yes, there's definitely a North American sensibility to some of the humor, but I don't think it's off the mark from what would have happened in a production that Donizetti himself had overseen.
That's the trick with any kind of period production of a comedy, to get to the universal aspects of humor. The pratfall is a pratfall.
Well, and trying to tie this in, for me at least, to a Hawaii audience, there are certain Hawaiian references in the piece, because truly I think this piece is early operetta. It sort of got a jump in the field ahead of Gilbert and Sullivan, mm-hmm. but it's in that vein, the fact that there is spoken dialogue, of course, but also this is that traditional love story out of the Commedia dell'arte tradition, but then you begin to play around with the details and with the fun of it, and hopefully we've taken that in the right direction for our crowd.
You have the whole idea of the girl raised among men, the tomboy kind of finding her female identity.
And I think that's one of the fun parts, and what an appropriate time for us to be doing.
And what more universal subject.
Exactly.
Right?
And it's nice just to see the show that it's nobody dies. It is on her terms. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are forces that work against her, but you never, ever doubt from the opening moments of the overture that all will be well and that Marie, the true daughter of the regiment, will end up just fine.
There's something refreshing about having that knowledge as you go through a show, that nobody's going to die, that you're not going to get your heart broken.
I do an awful lot of operas, of course, and the tragedies and the dramatic pieces are, in a way, easier to do because there's that great big arc of sadness that goes from beginning to end. And they always say comedy is the hardest thing, but it's exhilarating to be able to play around with these notions and ideas and to focus on having a good, fun evening for people where they can forget what's going on in the rest of the world for a night and just enjoy themselves.
Well, yeah, because it's not hard to get sorrow out of an audience when the person they've fallen in love with just died. Oh,
this is probably not the piece for this, but for me, the ultimate goal in theater is when you can make people laugh and cry in the same evening.
Sure.
The greatest sound in a crackling noise in the audience is somebody opening up their purse and bringing out a Kleenex to wipe away a tear, but then have a pratfall shortly thereafter and
yeah.
get the laughter as well.
Which and life gives us those opportunities to jump from one extreme of feeling to the other.
Yes, but, you know, on a Friday night or a Sunday afternoon or whatever, sometimes you just want to let something wash over you, to lose yourself in it, and to simply have fun. That the great moral lessons to be learned from Daughter of the Regiment, if you can find them, please let me know what they are, because this is not that kind of piece.
So you can assure the audience it would be an evening free of life-changing moral lessons.
Well, it depends on who's in the audience, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a good time.
But you're going to have a good time without a life-changing moral lesson.
Yeah, I'll go back to the life-changing moral lessons on the next show.
Sure, sure. Well, there's always time for that, right? The well-known theatrical maxim that comedy is much tougher. Why do you think that is?
Part of it is in the timing. It is two jokes aren't funny, but three can be. Mm-hmm. A pratfall is not funny unless somebody else is in on the game, the psychology that is behind it. Very often with the serious work, you go into somebody's head, whether this is Shakespeare or opera or a modern piece, and you are delving into the psychology of them. With comedy, there's a whole different brittleness, a certain mm-hmm. edge to it, and you have to figure out how to make that work, both for your own comic sensibilities, but be in touch with the comic sensibilities of the audience as well.
Well, absent some knowledge of who the character is falling down, a pratfall is just a fall, unless it's somebody that's a pompous, you know, blowhard and who's, you know, sort of you're hoping to deflate. I mean, you have to have some reason for that pratfall to be something other than somebody falling on his face, right?
And therefore, you have to build that whole story into it before you can lead up to said banana peel slip or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's a different process, a different development. I find it's amazing. You've got some people who are geniuses at comedy but must never play Radames or Aida, mm-hmm. and other people who can do anything comically, and they can make that transfer. It is just, it's a different key, a different trick in the box.
Going back to what you said about the timing of comedy being essential, and that's something on which everyone agrees, but we've all seen jokes that had you waited a half second would have been funnier or would have been less funny. And that's very inexact science, isn't it? You know, when to drop that punchline, how long the setup should be before you deliver the laugh.
Well, right? It's one of the most difficult things in opera because, of course, the composer sets the times, sets the beats, sets all of that. So you have to connect to his or her comic sensibilities. And then the other difficulty, I think, with opera or theater is that you have to wait until you've got that number one component, the audience, there with you.
Yeah.
So we can rehearse something for days and days and we think that it's funny, but until you actually have an audience there, that you're not entirely sure. So with our dress rehearsal, this was our first opportunity with Daughter of the Regiment to have a full audience with us, and you can just see people's brains turning on the stage going, okay, that works. That needs, as you just said, the extra beat or whatever. So Jake Gardner, who plays the Sulpice in the show, he says, I'm always best with my 20th performance of a comic role because you finally get that dynamic between yourself and the audience in place.
And for performers and for you as a director, there's a kind of an extrasensory understanding of where an audience is at, right? You're kind of in the back of the room sensing whether they're with it or not.
Well, for me, I was telling somebody at our dress rehearsal that's the most nervous performance for me because it's as much as me trying to gauge the audience. I'm more in trying to be more in tune to with what they are doing than I am with the people on stage and figuring out, Is our dynamic working? Are we connected to each other? So let's hope.
Well, is how's it feel?
I'm really pleased at the moment. It's as I said, I'm doing this show for the first time. Most of the performers are doing the show for the first time, and so there's been all of these discoveries along the way. And yeah, I'm having a really fun time with this crowd here in Hawaii.
Brian Diedrich is the director of the Hawaii Opera Theater production of Donizetti's Daughter of the Regiment, which runs this weekend at the Blaisdell Concert Hall.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, and Hawaii Pacific University.
And that's it for this week. Coming up next week on The Conversation, on Monday, as the number of water fatalities continues to climb, we'll sit down with a panel of ocean safety experts.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217.
If you missed part of The Conversation or any other program we air on HPR, you can find them on the HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Join us Monday and pick up The Conversation.